Tim Cook has just 2 weeks ago proven that he is the most cunning CEO of our times.
That is not a very popular opinion, but perhaps by the end of this video, you will agree with me. The genius of Steve Jobs was fairly obvious for anyone to see. He was the guy behind the Mac, the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. But this is decidedly not where the strength of Tim Cook lies. The most successful devices launched during his tenure were the Apple Watch and the AirPods, which are both accessories to Steve Jobs' iPhone, and meanwhile the Vision Pro has so far failed to change the world. And yet it is Tim Cook who made Apple the world's most valuable company, increasing their value 25 times over since he became the CEO 14 years ago. And 8 of those years even happened during the biggest trade war of our time, where Apple really should have been uniquely badly exposed. After all, it is the US company with the biggest reliance on both Chinese manufacturing and Chinese consumers by far. Trump and the Chinese government both have massive leverage and great incentives to strong-arm Apple, but instead, Tim Cook has managed to secure more support than ever for his company from both sides. And now, with international tensions on the rise everywhere, Cook is plotting his most elaborate plan yet. And if he can pull this one off too, I think he'll be cemented as one of the greatest CEOs of all time. This video was sponsored by my streaming service, Nebula. When Steve Jobs returned to Apple in 1997, his company was in a state of ruin. Its former management left it bleeding cash, talent, and customers, and so Jobs decided that they needed major reforms in two areas. First, Apple needed radically better products, which Jobs jumped on himself very publicly. But quietly and behind the scenes, an equally important task was the reinvention of how those products would actually be made, and for that, he brought in Tim Cook as one of his first hires. Apple had historically been producing its Macintosh computers in-house in California, with Jobs proudly saying that, quote, "This is a machine that is made in America just a decade or so earlier." But Cook had previously worked for the PC giant Compaq, who had long embraced outsourcing, and as their supply chain expert, he was tasked to help Apple make the transition to outsourcing too. Compaq was, for example, one of the first major customers of Foxconn who made cases for their PCs. Cook convinced them to jump over to Apple and to, for example, make their aluminum alloy case for the PowerMac G5. Over time, he wooed a host of other suppliers who would become critical to Apple, from TSMC to Samsung and more over as well, and he tied them together into a massive web that was perfectly tuned to bring the products to life that Apple's designers and engineers dreamed up. Unlike Jobs, who was almost tyrannical at times, Cook was quiet, incredibly likable, and able to convince partners to take almost impossible bets on the company. Foxconn, for example, was reportedly convinced to assemble the original iPhone at a clear loss because they're convinced that doing so would help them win Apple's trust and more lucrative contracts further down the line. They were not wrong, of course, and many others followed. If Jobs' focus on dreaming up new products was Apple's yin, then Cook's focus on finding the right partners and making sure that everything was actually built efficiently was their yang. And perhaps Cook's most important partnership was the one that he built with China. He didn't just accept the country, he fully embraced them. Designed by Apple in California, made in China. The second half of the sentence is the legacy of the first 20 years of Tim Cook at Apple, and this partnership has been incredibly lucrative for them so far. Early on, most of the negotiating and relationship building was reportedly done on behalf of Cook by Terry Kuo, the charismatic CEO and founder of Foxconn. He frequently visited the country, he wined and dined with local politicians, and lobbied them for favorable treatments on behalf of his clients. And support is what they got unlike any other, like, for example, in what's colloquially called iPhone City. A New York Times investigation revealed that the Chinese government basically built a whole city for Apple, including spending $600 million on a manufacturing complex, $1 billion on the housing of workers. The government built massive energy infrastructure, gave loans, helped recruit and train workers, paid various subsidies and bonuses, eliminated corporate taxes and value-added taxes for 5 years, and also created the so-called bonded zone, an area inside China that the country essentially considers foreign soil, subject to different import and export rules. And iPhone City is just one of multiple production sites built on behalf of Apple and the country. Tim Cook negotiated conditions for what are perhaps the world's best factories with perhaps the world's best conditions, and combined with the ability of Jobs to make hit products, the company seemed unstoppable. Everything was going well and in balance until, of course, Steve Jobs passed away. And perhaps unexpectedly, he suggested that Cook should be his successor. At first, this didn't really make sense to me. It seemed to me that Apple would both need a new, brilliant product person and Tim Cook to together work their magic. But in retrospect, that didn't seem to be the case. Around Jobs' death, Apple had already entered an altogether different era. With the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac, Apple already had what would be the biggest consumer-facing computing categories covered. The products didn't fundamentally need to be reinvented for the next decade or two at least, they just needed iterations, and Jobs left behind a team that would be more than capable of doing that. Instead, the goal was now to push these products much harder than ever before, and that didn't really require massive innovation, but instead politics and deal-making. And that, as it turns out, is Tim Cook's unparalleled gift. He can play all sides simultaneously like a fiddle. The most impressive and recent example of this is this press release that Apple put out about 2 weeks ago. In it, the company announced that it will spend more than $500 billion in the US over the next 4 years. This is a document that is very obviously framed to please President Trump. After all, the man, even 9 years ago, made it one of his campaign promises to bring Apple's manufacturing back to the US.
We're going to get things coming. We're going to get Apple to start building their damn computers and things in this country instead of in other countries.
And the press release, at least at first glance, appears like Apple was doing exactly that. The company describes the $500 billion as being their largest ever spent commitment. They're saying that they're opening a new manufacturing facility in Houston. They're doubling Apple's US Advanced Manufacturing Fund from $5 billion to $10 billion. They plan to hire around 20,000 highly skilled people in the US. And finally, they're opening a new manufacturing academy in Detroit for good measure too. As you can imagine, the media and Trump, of course, had a field day with this. Everything about this document is a political masterpiece because it simultaneously lets Trump loudly claim to his followers that he is bringing US manufacturing back to the US using his policies, while also not actually requiring Apple to do pretty much anything at all. Let's read this document a little bit closer to see what I mean. That $500 billion figure, which is Apple's largest spend commitment ever, of course, is a huge figure. It sounds like a lot, except those included $350 billion in 2018 and then $430 billion in 2021, and those pretty much lead directly in a straight line to $500 billion today. Yes, the number did go up, but of course Apple also grew proportionally in that time period, and of course all the other tech companies are in a massive spending frenzy due to AI right now, and so Apple's $500 billion figure is kind of expected, or like exactly in the middle of the pack, nothing particularly surprising. Same with the figure of 20,000 new jobs. First of all, they're all in R&D, silicon engineering, software development, and AI and machine learning, which all sounds very good, but of course those are all jobs that Apple had traditionally hired for in the US anyway. I mean, the first half of the sentence goes designed by Apple in California, and all of those roles fall under that bucket, while 20,000 new hires is also about what you'd expect from Apple over 4 years in a massive AI hype cycle. So far, they've only really put shiny numbers on pretty much business as usual, but the next part actually gets really smart. They say they are doubling Apple's US Advanced Manufacturing Fund from $5 billion to $10 billion, and I find this particularly entertaining. First of all, because a fund, it sounds like kind of a concrete thing, right? You'd think that it's maybe like a special bank account that maybe Tim Cook has just sent another $5 billion to or something like that. But no, it doesn't actually get defined anywhere in the document. It just gets created out of thin air. It is just a concept, and I think it doesn't actually mean anything. Most likely, this fund is just a name that Apple gave to a bunch of money that they say they will spend on buying US components at some point in the future. There is no specific time frame attached to it, as far as I can find, and so one can double it pretty much at will. But better yet, the biggest thing that this fund will pay for are chips from TSMC's new Arizona fab. And Apple boasting that this is somehow their achievement and potentially even that of Trump is absolutely hilarious if you think about it. This, of course, isn't a fab that Apple built. That was TSMC. It is also not a fab that Apple financed. That was, again, TSMC and Joe Biden's government, who gave them $6.6 billion in subsidies from their CHIPS Act. An act that Trump is right now trying to kill, by the way, by firing its workers. Apple's whole job was graciously accepting that they will buy chips from a world-class fab that was basically handed to them at a discount. The fab, of course, has already went live before Trump entered office, and according to Tim Kalpin, it already started making the A16 and S9 chips for Apple already, and so in other words, Apple buying from them is already a given too. But of course, Tim Cook is a master politician, and so he's packaged all of this up into something called Apple's US Advanced Manufacturing Fund, which implies that all of this is an achievement of Apple and potentially Trump. Smart. Okay, and for the next two statements, I'm going to be a little bit more brief because I think you already got the point. Apple claims that they have a new manufacturing facility in Houston that will make, wait for it, AI servers. Now, AI servers sounds like an incredibly strategically important product, and maybe it is, but in the context of manufacturing, the thing that it is Apple's lowest volume product, perhaps ever. The factory will almost certainly just assemble ready-made components, and together with the Mac Pro, which is already made in the US too, it will probably make up less than 1% of Apple's manufacturing combined. The factory is also rumored to be from Foxconn, so of course Apple won't build it itself, and its primary job will pretty clearly be to serve as basically a showroom where politicians can be taken for photo ops. All the high-volume production and anything requiring complex miniaturization, like a watch or a phone for example, actually remains abroad. And finally, let's talk about a new manufacturing academy in Detroit, which, you'll be surprised to hear, Apple actually gave no real details about either. An academy in Detroit could be anything from a giant university to basically a single room with two random dudes who occasionally host a class if they feel like it. They didn't actually tell us which one it is or where in the spectrum it is, so that makes me think it is closer to the second. In other words, this document perfectly encapsulates Tim Cook's brilliance. He gave Trump a fantastic list of things to brag about with big numbers and all the right words. He even met the president just before putting out the press release, so newsrooms couldn't miss the connection even if they wanted to. During the last presidency of Trump, his similar negotiations led to his company's products being given specific exemptions from Chinese tariffs so that they could continue to be imported freely into the US. And you can bet that he's angling for similar concessions with what he's doing here now too. Brilliantly, these statements have not really cost Apple anything meaningful so far, and they've also helped Apple avoid upsetting any of their other international partners as well. Because guess what? Trump is not the only party that Cook has to keep happy. There's, of course, also China. The elephant in the room is, of course, China, who somehow still continues to support Apple to this day. Just as an example, a few years ago, when factories producing Apple products were suffering pandemic-related labor shortages, the Chinese government immediately sent large numbers of military veterans and Communist Party members to try to help the factories get back on track. Now that smells like a bromance. And just as importantly, China is still Apple's second largest market, with iPhones being absolutely ubiquitous in any wealthy Chinese city. And remember that while this was happening, Huawei was getting sanctioned, TikTok was almost forced to sell, Tencent was designated as a military company, and so on. And it's clear to see that Cook has somehow miraculously managed to keep his company on the good side of the CCP as well. I've already made a whole video explaining all the concessions that Cook made to befriend China historically in the first place, that is linked down in the description. And as long as Apple kept their massively profitable production in China, the government was unlikely to do anything drastic to it, as over a million jobs and hundreds of billions of dollars were on the line. But here's the tricky part. While Apple has been able to delay having to move its production out of China, that won't last forever. The company has already started opening factories in other countries like Vietnam, for example, and India in particular is dead set on becoming its next major assembly destination, while the country's Tata Group is angling to become to Apple in India what Foxconn was to them in China. But there are two massive threats that Cook has to navigate in this transition. The first one was demonstrated by Indonesia just recently, where the government officially banned Apple products from being sold unless they opened a factory in the country. Apple caved and quickly announced a $1 billion manufacturing plant soon after. Everyone can feel that Apple's massive business is up for grabs, and they'll try both carrots and sticks to get that over to their country. Tim Cook has to navigate all of this, and that won't be easy. But the second and much bigger problem is that Apple can't actually just leave China. For now, Apple is still critically reliant on the country. Its factories abroad still don't have the capacity to cover global demand, and they also still require machines, engineers, training, and components from China. Meanwhile, the country's leadership is extremely keen on keeping it this way. After all, having the world's most valuable company and America's crown jewel critically vulnerable to them is a massive source of leverage. It is a very lucrative neck that they can choke if things get really ugly. In fact, I think one of the big reasons why they didn't actually strike Apple while their own companies were being hurt is that they need Apple to stay as strong and as resilient as possible as a sort of trump card. But the more Apple moves its production out of China, the less this protection becomes necessary. And if Apple becomes anything close to independent, China doesn't really have an incentive to hold back anymore. We've seen reports of officials getting increasingly strict about what Apple is allowed to move out of the country, including important machines, people, and know-how. And the government also started antitrust investigations into Apple's supposed App Store monopoly in China just recently. Those are very clear warning shots, meant to say that Apple is sacred in China as long as it cooperates, but after that, it is not. So far, Tim Cook has brilliantly managed to slowly drift away from China without catastrophic consequences, but now comes his biggest test. Will he be able to complete his decoupling before China's jaws snap shut on his company's neck? If yes, that will be the crowning achievement of him as a CEO. Designed by Apple, perhaps in California, but made no longer in China. And throughout this video, the other iconic American company that you might have been thinking about as one having massive reliance on China is probably Tesla. And if you'd like to hear how they are navigating their tricky situation, then I've made a whole second video about just that that is available exclusively on Nebula. This video explains how and why China cuddled up to them in the first place and what their decoupling might look like as well. It joins a lot of other bonus content that I've made for the platform, plus also whole Nebula original series, full documentaries like Tom Nicholas's brilliant movie about boomers, and more. There are of course no ads on Nebula, and many of our videos, including this one, often even appear on Nebula with early access. Nebula is an online streaming service built and owned by many of YouTube's best educational creators, including me, and its business model is refreshingly simple. There are no shady trackers, ads, or hidden agendas, just a simple subscription that helps you fund us, which in turn lets us create more and better content for you. And better yet, with my link go.nebula.tv/techalter, which is also linked in the description, you can even get an extra discount, which brings the price down to just $36 a year. That is cheaper than the $60 it would cost with the generic link, so be sure to use mine in the description or scan the QR code. Oh, and if you absolutely hate ongoing subscriptions, you can opt for a lifetime option. While if you want to buy Nebula for someone else, you can do that with a really cute digital gift card. And finally, new Nebula subscribers even get access to something called guest passes, so they can actually share a week's worth of Nebula content with their loved ones. All the links are in the description. I hope you enjoyed the Tesla video, and I'll see you in the next one.